And then he was the guest again last night, and he has a chance to tie it here. Oh. And he might do better than that. Deep right field, Grossman is all the way back. Gone!
Royals win again. I'm telling you, folks, you got to hurry up and get these seats before they're gone on a Royals bus trip. We got about 10 available to the public. 545-3220. Boys in blue look like they're vastly improved from a year ago. Their starting pitching is out of sight. The bullpen may be starting to figure some things out. And MJ Melendez hitting the cover off the ball right now. And he's one of those young and up-and-coming players for the Royals. Exciting to watch. And the Royals win again. So if you like on the Royals bus trip, give us a call, station 545-3220. And we can tell you more about how you can buy a ticket to be on the trip and have a great time watching the Royals take on the defending World Series champion Texas Rangers. This is a Sports Ticket brought to you by Kiefer Brothers Automotive in Beloit, your home for fast, friendly auto repair. MJ Melendez with a home run to give the Royals a lead for good. They were down 3-0, but came back. Hunter Renfroe with a two-run homer, one of the free agent acquisitions for the Royals in the offseason. Provides some pop in the lineup. Melendez gave him the lead for good. Alec Marsh, 3 runs, no decision as a starter. John Schreiber's been a terrific pickup in that trade with the Red Sox. Pitched the inning, a scoreless relief. He hasn't given up a run yet. Will Smith now becoming more of a setup man, which is what I thought would have made sense when they acquired him. James MacArthur becoming the closer, it appears. And the Royals mow him down last 2 innings. They're now 6-4. And we talked about last week, they were going into the series at home against the White Sox. And said they need to win 3 out of 4. White Sox aren't very good right now. Win 3 out of 4, you'll be back to 500. They did better than that. They get the sweep over the White Sox. And here's Matt Cotrero, the manager of the Royals, on getting that 4-game sweep.
These guys are high right now. You know, it's you win, and that's, you know, we've made that very clear that that's what our objective is. Now, you can't, you're not proclaiming anything over 10 games, but it's better than the alternative for sure.
Well, there's the secret.
These guys are high right now.
They're high right now. That's the key. They're high. They're high. Oh, wow.
High okay. On life.
High on, well, no, I don't know. I mean, you can put that in there. It could be right. Could be high on whatever. But
on all kinds of things.
Okay. But life is a good answer, Dusty. Good answer. You know, if you're thinking anything else, well, okay. That could be a good answer as well. Hey, whatever works. Hey, you know, there's some athletes would get drunk as a skunk the night before and perform the next day, believe it or not.
They're playing in Missouri, so.
the Royals now 6-4. They're back on the field to start a 3-game series against the Astros tomorrow night. The Astros are off to a 3-7 start, but they do have one positive. Houston Astros right-handed pitcher Ronel Blanco took a no-hitter into the 6th inning against the Rangers yesterday. Rangers lost to the Astros. Astros get the win 3-1. Adolis Garcia broke up the no-hitter with a 2-out single. Blanco no-hit the Blue Jays on Monday in his first start of 2024. So why is this noteworthy? Blanco started the year throwing 14 2/3 innings of hitless baseball. Not shutout baseball.
Yeah.
Hitless baseball. It is the best streak to start a season since 1961. Believe it or not, the previous record was 11 3/3 innings done by 3 relievers, and one of them is a Royal. I don't even know if he's a Royal or not anymore. Want to take a guess?
Ooh.
Very recent. In fact, it happened last year.
Oh, man. I've already forgot
his name?
Everybody.
Austin Cox.
Yeah, not a chance I would have come up with
that. I remember he
name.
Started out great and couldn't give up anything.
Yeah.
And then I think he had like a spot start.
I would not have come up with that if I'd have been here the rest of the day.
Yeah. Josh Hader did it with the Brewers in 2020. Hader's now the closer for the Astros.
Mm-hmm.
Brad Klontz did it in 1996 for the Braves. So. And here's the good news for the Royals. They won't face Blanco. He just pitched yesterday. So the Royals' 3-game set against the Astros will not, they won't face what looks to be their ace right now. And the Astros are scuffling a little bit, so the Royals could catch them at a good time. And the Royals are playing good ball after the 4-game sweep. Listen, we said it on paper that the Royals are better. And there's no doubt they're better. Can't get much worse, 56-106. But, you know, a couple of keys. The starting pitching has been magnificent. It has been absolutely the best starting rotation in baseball, and it's not even close. And they probably should be 8-2 instead of 6-4. The bullpen has blown a couple of games, but this is why we were talking about last week. There's no need to panic and freak out because you trust that the manager is going to make some adjustments, and he has since you and I spoke last week.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about finding roles. The bullpen isn't usually defined in April. The bullpen is defined usually in August in September, as you go in October, hopefully, in the playoffs. So you don't have to have your bullpen perfectly refined and defined at the very beginning of the year. It's kind of a check and balances, trial and error. You experiment a little bit with guys in different roles, and eventually you figure it out. It's no different than basketball, when you're trying to figure out who's your fifth starter or who's the top guy off the bench or who's better off the bench. It's no different than, you know, in football, trying to figure out, you know, who's my nickel or my dime corner, or who's going to be my situational pass rusher, who's going to be my third down back, who's going to be my swing tackle. And there's all kinds of things. Who's going to be my backup quarterback? Sometimes that's part of it they try to figure out as well. So it takes some time to figure some things out. And listen, the Royals pitching had to be improved from last year, and the Royals have completely revamped that rotation. Brady Singer's back. Cole Reagans was picked up the middle of last season. Reagans will start tomorrow night. And he's been sensational so far, but getting Zach Greinke run support thus far this year. But you've got Reagans. Lugo's pitched very well. Waka was outstanding the other day. Singer has been terrific so far. And Alec Marsh wasn't great yesterday, but was terrific his first start. And yesterday he battled. So the Royals haven't had to implode the bullpen yet to eat seven innings like they did, five times at the beginning of last year, it seemed like? I mean, it seemed like in the month of April, their bullpen was worn out already. And the Royals have 6 wins, and we're at April 8th. Last year, they had 7 wins at the end of April.
Mm-hmm.
So they're definitely an improved team pitching-wise. Defensively, I think they're pretty solid. Remember, Michael Massey is hurt. He's on the injured list at second. Offensively, Garcia's off to a nice start. Bobby Witt Jr. is doing fine. Melendez is ripping the cover off the ball, and he's been one that I've been questioning a little bit, and now he's putting it together perhaps. Vinny Pascatino hasn't even hit yet. I mean, you know Pascatino's going to hit. At least you think he will. He's going to hit. And so the Royals offensively, I think, to me, this is just me, I think the Royals' biggest question is offensively. I still think it's offensively. Is Hunter Renfroe going to provide? Now, he hasn't hit very well yet. Now, if he can get going. So the Royals got 3 or 4 guys in their lineup who are not exactly hitting the cover off the ball. Wait till those guys get going. Salvi's not been red hot to start here either. He's okay. He's off to a decent start. But, man, you get these other guys, and then Michael Massey comes back at second, and Massey came on offensively last year. And I think they're okay offensively without Massey at second, but he's a good defensive player at second. So, you know, it's not the end of the world. They don't have Massey for a little while. But this is a team right now that is definitely improved. We thought it before the season, got off to a 1-2 start, and now they've won 4 in a row. And here's the thing. People can sit here and degrade the sweep. Well, it's the White Sox. They're not good. They're 1-8. They're not good. That's true. But if you're a good team, you take care of the bad teams. How many times have we seen over the years where the Royals have been average or not good and can't beat the bad teams?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? They can maybe somehow hang with the Astros, but they can't beat the bad teams.
Exactly.
Happened last year.
Yeah.
So for them to take care of business in a 4-game sweep at home against the White Sox is pretty impressive. So you got to be encouraged by what the Royals are doing right now.
Yeah. I mean, just this is baseball, right? Like you said, they honestly should probably be 8-2 right now, but mm-hmm. there's going to be games where things aren't going to go your way, and you're going to lose some of those games that you should have won. It's a 162-game season. If you go through the entire season winning every game you should have and losing every game you should have, then that wouldn't be any fun. It wouldn't be normal at all. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have games where it's going to slip away, or you're going to have a game where if you watched the 2014 and 15 Royals, there's games that looked like they were dead to rights, and they ended up winning them. So those are a lot of games in those 2 years where people said they probably should have lost that game.
Mm-hmm.
And then they won it and won a World Series, right? And so, you know, all that's going to happen within the course of a 162-game season. And then if you're lucky enough to make it to the playoffs and continue on. So, yeah, I mean, you're not going to, you know, go through unscathed on some of those things. But, yeah, obviously, I mean, it doesn't take – I'm not a math whiz, but if you've got 6 wins by April 7th and you only had 7 an entire month to start the year last year, you're better. And so now you just got to build off of that and take advantage of the situation that you had with the White Sox coming in and getting that sweep. And now just you move forward from that and you build off of it.
Absolutely. And the early returns right now, we played about 10 games for most teams, and we still only have 152 to go.
Yeah.
But the Yankees are off to a great start. They're 8-2. The Red Sox off to a good start. They're 7-3. Oh, no. Those guys are back. They're at the top of the division early on. The Guardians off to a 7-2 start. Tigers are 6-3. The Royals 6-4, and they're in third. The Rangers 6-3 in the AL West have a game lead over the Angels. We mentioned the Astros off to a rough start at 3-7. The NL East, the Braves are off to a 6-2 start, but you see Spencer Strider probably blew out his arm again.
Yeah,
that's just unfortunate. He's gonna have to probably have Tommy John surgery a second time. The Mets started out 0-5, but they won three of the last four. But boy, listening to the announcers for the Mets broadcast is absolutely depressing and fun and funny at the same time. Pirates off their best start in years. They're 8-2. Seems like the Pirates always start out well, and then at the end of the year they're down. They're 20 games under.
Yeah.
Brewers are 6-2. Cubs off to a good start, 6-3. In fact, NL Central, no losing record. Cardinals are in last place. They're 5-5. Dodgers, how can they not be good? They're 8-4 with a $1 billion payroll. Padres are 5-7. D-backs 4-6. They've both spent some money. So the Dodgers are the only team with a winning record in NL West. But it's early after just 10 games. Just an early look at where things stand in Major League Baseball. All right, local sports. We got some volleyball players and some football players in the news here in North Central Kansas.
Yes, Saturday the Kansas Volleyball Association announced their selections for the annual All-Star Match, which will be held on June 1st in Topeka, and two area athletes have been selected to play in that. Beloit's Miley Brown picked for the red team, and Smith Center's Cameron Hutchinson was selected for the blue squad. So, again, two area athletes that will be competing in that as long as they can accept those invitations and get to Topeka on June 1st. And you can check out a full look at the selections for this year's match for the KVA All-Star Match at ncksports.com. Two area football players last week signing letters of intent to play at the collegiate level, as Beloit's Christian Mears signed at Doan University in Crete, Nebraska. Had a great season, especially as a return specialist for the Beloit football team as a senior, and did some good things on defense as well, and interspersed offensively with Brad Gober's squad. So he's on to the next level. Christian Mears is at Doan. And then Ian Christine, who had a great four-year career, starting varsity player all 4 years for Lakeside, and he's off to Kansas Wesleyan to play football at the next level. They're in Solana, so you can read about both of them. Ian following his cousin Vanessa, who played women's basketball at Kansas Wesleyan as well. So Ian headed to Kaywood to play football there in Solana. Again, you can read much more about both of those players at ncksports.com.
Coming up in 30 seconds, perfection in college athletics.
I'm Elijah at Kiever Brothers Automotive in Beloit. Did you know that we sell tires? We also perform alignments and all the other services that go along with them. We handle all the top brands, extras like road hazard warranty, complimentary tire rotations, and complimentary tire repairs are available for purchase on most tires. Right now, we are offering $80 off when you buy a set of four. Call or stop by Kiever Brothers Automotive for fast, friendly tire services today. Find us just south of the courthouse in Beloit or on the web at KieverBrothers.com.
Iowa with the basketball, they'll bring it across, the clock will tick down. The Gamecocks are making history in Cleveland. They'll be the 10th team, the 5th program to go undefeated and win the national championship. They will avenge their loss to Iowa from last year. The clock ticks down, 2 seconds to play, celebration in Cleveland. Perfection wears garnet and black. The South Carolina Gamecocks complete their first perfect season with their 3rd national championship. The best team in the nation will cut down the nets as the Gamecocks defeat Iowa 87-75 here in Cleveland. The confetti falls from the sky, celebration at midcourt. The Gamecocks are national champions again. History in Cleveland, an undefeated season for the Gamecocks at 38-0, the most wins in program history. They will hoist the trophy and cut down the nets.
South Carolina, the perfect season. They complete it. I won $50. $50. Remember that story I told you about my good buddy?
Basically the beginning of the year, wasn't it, when you were talking about all that, and I agreed with you that South Carolina would win this rematch.
What's funny is my buddy may have had a few when he made that bet. I reminded him of that. He goes, $50, question mark. I go, yes. And he said, do you think I was a little bit tipsy? And I'm like, perhaps, but hey, that's your choice, not me.
Yeah, I didn't do that.
He was the one that told me Kenton Clark was the greatest player he's ever seen, and he started telling me about how Iowa was better than everybody else, and he said, I think I'd take Iowa versus the field. I'm like, I'll take the field. Then we narrowed it down. It was South Carolina. I started talking about how South Carolina is better than Iowa. He goes, who's better than Iowa? I said, South Carolina is. And I said, why? Because they're both good defensively and offensively. And he's like, no. And he's like, well, I'll bet you, I think I said $100 to start. I should have done that. But I got him down to 50 because I'm like cheap from that standpoint.
You're nice, yeah.
Yeah, or nice. There you go.
I'm going to say nice because I think more people agreed with us on that.
I think so. And so, but it came down to basically South Carolina, Iowa. If they played, that would be our wager. Mm-hmm. And I thought Iowa would lose earlier, and they almost lost second round. Then I was sweating a little bit because Iowa made it to the final, but I still thought South Carolina would win. But it's crazy that him and I both, he was on the Iowa bandwagon. I was on the South Carolina bandwagon. And that's who played for the championship.
So yeah.
Not too bad. South Carolina wins by 12. You know, Caitlin Clark did what she normally does. Scored a lot of points yesterday with 30. She had a championship game record, 18 in the first quarter. High scoring first half and first quarter. Iowa finishes there, you're 34-5. You know, one of the couple of reasons why I like South Carolina in this matchup was, one, they had more size. Iowa struggles rebounding. They're not as physical. So South Carolina is more physical. They have more size. And they're the better defensive team. Now, Iowa did score 75 on them, but that's below their season average. And they got to the great start, 10-0, but they couldn't hold on to that, and that's because it was early in the game. Here is Dawn Staley, as now she wins another title as a head coach. I think that's three now. Mm-hmm. It's pretty impressive what she's been able to do. Last year lost to Iowa in the national semifinals. They were undefeated at that point as well. And then had to basically restock the roster and then go undefeated this year. And she was very emotional after the game and explained that.
You carry the burden of, you know, every single one of your players, all the coaches and staff members that put so much into our team. And, you know, it's heavy load to be undefeated, to, you know, finish the job. You get emotional because you just want that for them, and you're happy that you're able to, because only one team wins a national championship.
Yeah, and then on top of that, the stress of going undefeated. And they were the favorite, and they blew a 22-point lead in a game earlier in the tournament, but they were able to get it done. So, and then Caitlin Clark, you know, she had a tremendous career, and Iowa was more than just Caitlin Clark. They had some really good role players that filled out well. And Caitlin Clark had an amazing career, no doubt, but Dawn Staley recognized Caitlin Clark and thanked her.
And I want to personally thank Caitlin Clark for lifting up our sport. She carried a heavy load for our sport, and it just is not going to stop here on the collegiate tour. But when she is the number one pick in the WNBA draft, she's gonna lift that league up as well. So Caitlin Clark, if you're out there, you are one of the GOATs of our games, and we appreciate you.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't say it better myself. I think that was terrific. Dawn Staley is the spokesperson now for women's basketball. I mean, Gina Auriemma was. The torch has been handed off. UConn is still very, very good. No doubt, made it to the Final Four. They had been hit by some injuries. South Carolina is the bar now, and that kind of changed when South Carolina beat UConn a few years in the national championship. That's kind of when the baton was passed. And Gino's an amazing coach still and great recruiter. Dawn Staley is too. But Dawn Staley, you know, for her to say that about Caitlin Clark, I thought was tremendous. She understands what Caitlin Clark did for the women's game. She understands what other players have done for the women's game. Of course, she was an amazing player herself. And now she's a terrific coach. And the other thing I read is that after everything happened, so forth, so on, you know, the celebration, and then she has to do all this other duties of a head coach, she came back out to the floor and did 30 minutes of one-on-one interviews with local media. And you don't have to do that.
No.
She did it. So she gets it. Dawn Staley gets it. And there's a lot of people love to play for Dawn Staley. I think she's demanding, but that's true of usually most championship head coaches. And to do what they did after losing a lot of talent to the WNBA last season, and then to avenge the loss to Iowa last year after losing in the semis, to win it all this year, it's a pretty impressive run.
Yeah, you don't get to where you're at here with a program like that based on just having fun, like some people want coaches to be, right? You get there because you put in the work, and you get there because you are demanding, and your kids know that when they come play for you, that you're going to be demanding. And it is what it takes to get to the highest level of anything. You've got to have a person at the top of that is getting the best and expecting the best from you. That's the only way you win. It's the only way you win at that level. And, you know, there's going to be coaches that might go about it a different way in their tactics of how they are demanding, or they're going to lead in a different – they're going to just, like, lead, and you're just going to know because of who they are. Or they're going to be real vocal and not maybe the nicest people in the world while they're doing it sometimes. But it is impressive what she's been able to build at South Carolina, because, I mean, how many times have we talked about, you know, back then it was like, if you can't grow this game in women's basketball mm-hmm. and get rid of UConn – the UConn Invitational is what I always called it back then. And, you know, they were winning that year after year after year. I said, you can't grow that and get other teams involved in this, then the sport's not going to grow. And not a whole lot of people are going to watch it. And you've seen women's basketball with South Carolina coming up and Caitlin Clark and all this other stuff that's going on just continue to grow. And it doesn't look like it's going to stop. You know, other people are going to have to carry that torch now that Caitlin Clark's gone in the college game. But, you know, there's been so much that's happened over the last seven probably years of women's hoops that it's fun to watch, because I've been watching women's basketball for a lot of years before it really blew up here.
A few things to talk about with the women's basketball game. You know, the ratings are through the roof. They're better than some men's sports that they posted in regards to the Elite Eight game between LSU and Iowa, the Final Four game Iowa was in against UConn, which was a great game, which we'll get to that in a moment. And then, of course, you know, South Carolina and Iowa in the national championship. And, you know, Doug Gottlieb, I agree with some things he says, some things I don't. And I'll give you an example. I'll give you two things that he talked about with the women's game. And he knows basketball. He really does. But there's one thing I totally disagree with him on, and another that I actually agree with him. And he says, why the women's game, you know, it's popular right now, and you got the star players, but why the women's game, is it going to continue to be watched at this pace or better? And to me, it depends on who the stars are. Mm-hmm. If they're promoting the stars, they have people like Caitlin Clark, you'll be all right. But if you don't, then you might go like golf we talk about. That where's the stars? We don't know who they are. We're living in Tiger and Phil's world, and those guys are now near 50 years old or older than 50. So you got to pass a baton at some point. So who's the person that's going to grab it from Caitlin Clark? Is it Juju Watkins of USC? Paige Beckers is coming back next year, but I mean, I don't think she doesn't. I mean, Caitlin was so flashy, the deep threes, the gunslinging mentality. You know, Sue Bird and Deion Taurasi was doing their little show, both UConn players, and Taurasi was asked by Sue, or somebody asked, you know, Gina Auriemma, would he ever let you do that, shoot shots from the logo and this and that, and Taurasi's like, he'd barely let us dribble, let alone do that. So she had to be in the right system, and thankfully she didn't get UConn that interested in her, and so she went to Iowa. It was the perfect fit. But, you know, what coach is going to let players shoot like that?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, some coaches won't. Gina Auriemma is not going to let somebody, I don't think, do that. I just don't think that's
not to that degree.
No.
Not at all.
And there'll only probably be maybe, you know, if you're not very good, you'll let it happen. And then maybe if the player is great enough to do it at a high level at Caitlin Clark, maybe you'll have the freedom. I mean, she still takes some bad shots. I mean, there was one.
For sure,
she took a couple in every game that I saw that were bad shots, but sometimes she makes them. Steph Curry sometimes does that. I mean, to me, that's the comparison. Is to the women's game what Curry is to the men's game is what Caitlin Clark is to the women's game. I think we'll see it in WNBA as well. But it'll be an adjustment for her, no doubt. Be more physical, more athletes. They can, you know, she didn't like being guarded all the way up the floor. The Connecticut did a good job on her. So that was one. But anyway, Doug Gottlieb said one of the reasons why the women's game isn't as enjoyable as the men's is because they miss a lot of easy shots. And they do. They miss a lot of layups. Mm-hmm. And it's usually at the rim trying to deal with contact. But as he pointed out, they're below the rim. You know, the guys play above the rim. Mm-hmm. They're playing below the rim. And he wasn't trying to say that they're bad. He was just point out an observation I think is very true, is that they're not jumping up and finishing and dunking. Clearly they're trying to finish at the rim, and I don't know how many open court layups where there's somebody chasing them and they miss a layup. That's not enjoyable when you see a lot of missed layups, and I think that's why you got to have the star power, because you're not having alley-oop dunks. No, that's what Clark is, the flashy, made eight threes, made one from the logo, guarded in her face, she still makes an amazing pass or shot. That's what draws people to the women's game right now, is some really good players, but in particular a player like Caitlin Clark. Are you going to have somebody like that going forward? You know, it would be really great as you get a player that can dunk. You know, that would help the women's game, there's no doubt. So I thought that was an interesting observation. I tend to agree with it. The one I don't agree with was the call with 3 seconds to go between Iowa and Connecticut. And let me tell you something. ESPN did a horrible job, and they set a narrative, and they conveniently left out the wide shot on a replay. They did not show the whole play in its entirety. They showed an angle that made it look like the screen wasn't that bad. How do you call a foul when Connecticut's trying to win the game? They're down one. How in the world can you call a foul on a screen like that? Very questionable, so forth and so on. But they showed the replay angles that helped their narrative. That's what they did. You can't tell me somebody in a truck didn't have a wide shot of what happened. It's very accessible after the game. So when people see the wide shot of what happened, it's clearly a moving screen. I mean, it is absolutely a blatant. I mean, you put a poster on what you can't do as a screener. That is the illegal screen. I mean, she actually was moving. She stuck her hip out, her elbow out, moved her whole body, and leaned in to Gabby Marshall, who didn't do anything wrong other than flail her arms to try to draw the call, which she got. The referee, to me, was the right call. And nobody, what was interesting after that whole thing is Scott Van Pelt, other people were like, oh, you hate to see this, you hate to see that. Others like, you just can't call that. But what was funny was nobody told us it was the wrong call. So what you're saying is they either made the right call, but you don't like they made the right call. And that's crap. Yeah. That is crap. What else is an official supposed to do? They made the right call, and now the officials get, well, they don't even say you made the wrong call. Now they say you made the right call, but the wrong time. That is bogus. There is no rule in the rule book that says you have to let them play the final minute. That is an unwritten rule that apparently baseball is getting into basketball now. And I saw other people like, well, you just can't do it. You know, you just can't. You got to let them play. Well, what happens if UConn does hit the shot and Gabby Marshall's laid out and it's a legal screen and UConn wins the game and Caitlin Clark's career ends on that play? Why didn't they call the screen? That's a prototypical text mark moving screen. That should have been called. They missed it. And then it's what? The officials missed it. But after the game, it was all this talk about you can't call that there. But they didn't say, those people, it was the wrong call. And then you get video to back up the official that ESPN did not provide. And next thing you know, and you got football players don't know jack about basketball, and certain people, talking heads, going, that's the worst call I've ever seen. I'm like, shut the hell up. Every time there's one bad call, the first thing somebody says is, that's the worst call I've ever seen. What, since yesterday when you posted that on Twitter about another game? No, it's not the worst call you've ever seen. Actually, take the time to shut the hell up. Stop before you post stuff on social media and go, let me think. There was a call in a game earlier this year. There was a call last week I said that. Maybe I shouldn't say the same thing over and over. It's the worst call I've ever seen until tomorrow. So it was the right call. It was the right call.
Well, what happened with 3 seconds left? They got to let them play.
So should we go ahead and just kick the officials off the floor and let them play rugby style? I mean, that's what you're saying. You're saying that the whistles should be thrown away. When you say the final minute, we should let them play, and you shouldn't or you can't call that. You're not arguing the call's wrong. You're arguing that you wanted to see a last-second shot that you were robbed of. But did you have really thing in the game here? Maybe you had money on UConn to win the game. Okay, now you're really ticked because the call was made. By the way, UConn, as somebody pointed out, Caitlin Clark missed a free throw. All that UConn had to do was rebound it. They'd been down two, advanced the ball in the women's game, had 3 seconds to still have a chance to win it. And they didn't. They didn't box out, and they gave up the rebound, and that was the game, too. And by the way, I've said this 1,000 times. Officials aren't perfect, but neither are the players. Neither are the coaches. Coaches get second guess. Players get second guess. But referees get second guess more than anybody. And what's amazing to me is this was the right call, and they get vilified even when they make the right call. And then you have this narrative and agenda that ESPN has, apparently. And then they don't show the wide shot that actually backs up and shows that it was absolutely, clearly, anybody knows anything about basketball knows the rules of the game and has officiated or actually coached. And I guarantee if Gino Auriemma goes back and watches this, he would probably tell you, oh, yeah, that was the illegal screen. Paige Beckers took the high road, said, listen, there's other plays that we mess up. Listen, how many layups did I just talk about earlier that both teams missed? UConn missed a whole bunch of layups, too. Why isn't everybody going out and yelling at somebody because they missed 2 layups instead of the official that made the right call?
Yeah.
Okay? And by the way, then you got the people that absolutely are absolutely despicable human beings. Gabby Marshall simply is playing defense. She was the one that got illegally screened. She did nothing wrong. She's just trying to guard Paige Beckers. The official makes the right decision. The person that makes the illegal screen isn't getting called about death threats because she made the illegal screen. But Gabby Marshall's getting death threats because she actually was the one that got screened. What did she do? And she had to pull her social media accounts because of it. What are we doing, people? First of all, if you're first of all, I don't want death threats towards anybody. I don't want any mean things said to anybody. But if you're going to have anything mean to say, it would be, honestly, on the player that committed the foul. Not the ref who got it right, and not the girl that ran into the screener who illegally screened. But you shouldn't say anything mean to anybody when it comes to any of that stuff. It blows my mind, and I wish social media was more accountable. I wish that you couldn't have some kind of handles to hide behind, because if you didn't have that protection, if you didn't have that protection, social media would be way better, wouldn't it? Like, people would be like, oh, crap, my name's going to, everybody's going to know who I am. I'm Joe next door, and people didn't know that I've been the one doing this all this time. I sit there eating my, you know, my bonbons, and, you know, like Peg Bundy did back on Married with Children, and I snuff in the Funyuns, and I've never played any competitive sport past junior high. But I'm an expert on officiating. I'm an expert on what a screen is, whether you should call it, and I'm an expert on, hey, I'm going to go troll Gabby Marshall and send her threats. What is wrong with people? It was a game, and we don't even know if UConn would have made the shot or not. And people would come back with, well, that's the point. We never got the opportunity to see it. And I understand the thinking. I understand the thinking. I'm not arguing. Right. I'm not arguing with the thinking. I personally would have loved to have seen it not called, and it was played as well. But you know what? Somebody says, well, you got to let it play out, and it's like we're being robbed of something. Well, wouldn't Iowa be robbed of something if it wasn't called? I mean, it goes both ways. Something illegal was done. Okay, and it was called, and that's why we have the rules, that's why we have the officials with a whistle in their mouth, and that was the right call, if you know what a legal screen is. So then Doug Gottlieb, here's where I disagree with him. So then Doug Gottlieb puts out a video of the Golden State Warriors and trust Steph Curry running off three screens and showing Draymond Green, all these guys having their elbows at people's necks, and they're moving, and he's like, see, this happens all the time. Doug, message to you, college women's basketball is not the NBA, it is a different game, and guess what? All those screens you showed are illegal. They're just not called. So he's not arguing. He's not arguing it's the right call by the official. He's saying you should let that go. Well, I don't think you should be able to elbow. I thought there's this thing where we go to the monitor and elbows that hit people's faces are what? Flagrant fouls, right? Yeah. So how in the world are you okay with her? Because she put her elbow up to right towards Gabby Marshall's shoulders and face. That's not a screen that you set. You're supposed to set your hands in front, shoulders and feet. You can't spread your legs way far to make this screen. I mean, you don't stick your hip out, your butt out, whatever else. So you're okay with a flagrant foul? Yeah. You're saying don't call that because it was close to being flagrant. Had she got the elbow higher, it would have probably smacked Gabby right in the face. And then you'd been like, well, you don't call that either? Then just go ahead and let him brawl like hockey did the other day to start the hockey match. I mean, it is amazing to me how we can sit here and you wonder why people don't want to officiate. There you go.
Absolutely. I was watching this game specifically. This is another impact that Caitlin Clark has had on the game. I've got two nephews that are in love with Caitlin Clark, right? And these are boys, right? So, like I said the other day when I was growing up, you know, and I don't know if this is on air or off air, but I love Cheryl Swoops, but I wasn't watching every Texas Tech game and knowing who else was on Texas Tech's team. My little nephew Walker knows every Iowa player on the team because he's been watching Caitlin Clark all year because he's in love with her, right? And it was so fun to watch him just watch the game, first of all. So we were watching very intently. And, you know, the replay angles, whatever ESPN showed, but I'm watching it live. I see slide, hip, and shoulder and elbow all at the same time. And it's like, well, that's a textbook. Like, I'm calling it out before the whistle even blows. I'm like, well, that's a moving screen.
I was wondering if they'd call it. That was my question.
Because they don't. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sitting here back behind everybody else, and I'm like, well, that's a moving screen before the whistle even gets blown, right? Because it is. It's textbook. It's slide, hip, shoulder, elbow, all in the same thing. And it's like, you can't do any of that, let alone all three of those things and get away with it. But they do not call it a lot. And I've seen
especially NBA.
Yeah, but I've seen it just dripping down to college sports with a lot of these calls that are not being made, and moving screens and travels were the two at the top of the list when I was watching that women's tournament in Manhattan in the first two rounds.
And there's no 3 second violation anymore either.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Nobody calls that.
Yeah, and so you get to the point where even you get to the higher levels here and you get deeper into the season, and I think officials don't want to make the calls that might decide something.
Right.
Maybe that's part of it. But I'm watching this and I get a message in our group that says that was an atrocious whistle. And I was like, hold on a second. Was it an atrocious whistle or an atrocious call? Because the call was right.
Yeah.
And basically it was the same thing that everybody else is saying. It's like, well, yeah, but they don't hardly ever call that. Why did they call it now? And it's like, well, I don't know, but it was a textbook moving screen because I saw it live. I didn't have to look at the replay. I'm like, that was 100% all three of the things you cannot do when you're screening. And so they got it right, and they called it. And even on the ones that aren't wide shot replays, you can still see the shoulder and elbow.
Well, the elbow shake can't be coming
and
up.
The hip too, really. Mm-hmm. You can't see the slide in those replays that they were showing. But man, that backside, or not backside, but front side, but wide replay, you see her just straight slide 2 feet over and hip check, elbow, everything out and knock her out of the play. And that's like, if I'm going to be at a techniques of officiating class, I'm going to be like, see what happened right here? Mm-hmm. This is not legal, and this is the textbook of it not being legal, because she did all of the things wrong on a screen here that is legal. And so that was, for me, was like, it was no question for me, even right when it happened, and even on the replays that we did get.
I want to say something. First of all, it's not an atrocious call. It is not an atrocious whistle either. It's just simply atrocious timing.
Exactly. And that's,
because she set the illegal screen. She's the one that set it, not the referee, not Gina or Emma. The girl set the illegal screen. It's atrocious timing. That's what it really is. It's not an atrocious call. It's not an atrocious whistle. The whistle is tied to the call. It is absolutely correct call. It's the right whistle to blow. The official was right there and saw it, was in good position to call it, wasn't out of position. The thing that everybody's caught up in is the atrocious timing. Atrocious timing isn't because of the official. It's because of the act that was made by the player. And yet somehow that is being completely excused and ignored. And yet Gabby Marshall's the one that gets threats. And I'm sure the officials have gotten threats too. But the person who did the illegal activity, poor her.
I kind of talked this person down. And by the end of it, they were like, yeah, textbook, I agree with you. And I'm like, well,
I don't know how you can disagree. You can't disagree that that wasn't a moving screen. If you disagree with that, then you might as well go ahead and get the
officials. Don't know basketball.
You don't know. That's exactly right.
That's
know basketball.
That's the thing, like, with you and I, and it helps that we've covered it and we're at games every Tuesday and Friday and watching basketball all the time in the winter, whether it's pro, college, or high school for us. Right. And so it is. It's like, for me, I mean, that's easy for me because I'm looking for stuff like that all the time. I'm like, are they going to blow a whistle because that was a moving screen? Or are they blowing a whistle because that pivot foot was clearly off the ground? And so those are the things that I'm always looking at and that are not being called with any kind of consistency right now. I think Cardosa traveled like 14 times yesterday and got called for two of them.
K-State announcing that Senator Ayoka Lee will use her final season of eligibility and return to K-State. We said that was what she should do, and she is. She averaged 20 points, 9 rebounds, 3 blocks a year ago, 61% from the floor. First team all Big 12 pick, second team All-American, and a leading rebound for K-State through 4 seasons all-time, and third all-time on the all-time scoring list for K-State. So that's huge for K-State, clearly. And, you know, Iowa, this is pointed out by a K-State fan, Iowa in Caitlin Clark's sophomore year lost in the second round of the tournament at home. And that's what K-State did. So they're like, you know what? Even it happened to Caitlin Clark. So hopefully build on it. Next year we can do better things instead of losing in the second round. Maybe that's what will happen. Got a much better chance now with Ayoka Lee back in the fold.
Absolutely. That's get her healthy.
Yeah.
Like fully ready to go for the start of the season.
No doubt about it. Now the men's championship game is set up by a couple of semifinal wins on Saturday.
The inbound to Taylor. 9 seconds to go. Taylor, 3 on the right wing. Won't go. Rebound, Fletcher Lawyer. And Purdue has one more step down Redemption Road. The team that lost last year to a 16 will play on Monday for a national title. Purdue 63, North Carolina State 50. The Boilermakers are in the title game for the first time since 1969. The inbound to Ross, and UConn can see history. One win away from a repeat national championship. The UConn Huskies advance to the title game on Monday with an 86-72 win over Alabama. It'll be UConn and Purdue, the two best teams all year long, playing for a national title.
Yep, Kevin Kugler, good friend there with the call. Westwood won, as it will be Purdue and UConn, the two ones advancing, as we predicted on the show on Friday. Alabama gave UConn a really good game. I thought they would, too, and they did for a while. And then it was 56-56, and UConn just hit another gear. NC State-Purdue wasn't a great second half for either team, but Purdue ended up winning the ball game by 13, didn't shoot it great. Edie didn't have a monster game. And so now the championship game is tonight, which I don't know why it's not 7:20 instead of 8:20, but that's late for everybody.
It's 9:20 on the East, yeah.
Yeah. I'll be from Glendale, Arizona. That's probably part of it, I guess, although they've usually been doing that. They'll be on TBS again tonight. Purdue and UConn. In my bracket, I had Purdue winning it all. So I should stick with that, right? On my pick on the show? We shall see. UConn, of course, is a pick by many in their brackets. And they have been the two best teams, the most consistent teams all year long. We look at this matchup tonight. A couple things stand out to me. I said, and I've said this for a few weeks, I think the only team that's capable of beating UConn in the field, and for me, I thought Carolina had a chance, but once they got eliminated, they're out. Purdue. And there's two ways of looking at this. You can sit here and you can say Purdue has a great chance because Zach Edey can neutralize Klingon. And Purdue guards are better than they were a year ago. And they shoot the three pretty well, one of the best three-point shooting teams in the country. And you can say, okay, there you go. That's the key to upsetting UConn. You got to make a lot of threes. Well, Alabama made a lot of threes and still lost by 14. The flip side argument, and I think a lot of people are going to look at it this way, is Edey will be neutralized because of Klingon, who's 7'2", Edey's 7'4", and Klingon's more athletic than Edey, in my opinion. And UConn has got better athletes to find those shooters quicker. And the other thing is, if you don't have to double Edey, now you can stay home on the guards on the three-point line. That takes away a big option on what Purdue wants to do offensively. UConn doesn't run their offense through Klingon.
Mm-hmm.
Purdue runs their offense through Edey. And I think that's the biggest reason why I think UConn is going to cut down the nets tonight. I know I picked Purdue in my bracket. And if Purdue wins it, that's awesome. I can sit here and I can brag tomorrow that I had it nailed. But when I look at this matchup, I don't see Purdue winning unless they make a lot of threes. I think Purdue's got to make 14 or 15 threes tonight. And they can. They're capable of it. But if you don't have to double Edey, and Klingon can block shots, and Edey doesn't exactly have a lot of lift. Klingon can make Edie's life miserable tonight. Purdue has to have Edey score probably 20 to win, at least 20, or they got to make a ton of threes. And the thing is, Klingon doesn't have to score at all for UConn to win. He really doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
He's a defensive stalwart. He can protect the rim. He alters shots. So if you drive it, you got to deal with him inside. And we've seen the last, Alabama, how many times Alabama go inside and kick it out? Because normally they shoot a little floater. And we saw what happened to Illinois, get destroyed in a 30-0 run. So now, could Klingon turn his ankle the first minute of the game? Could Klingon get in foul trouble? Then that changes things. There's no doubt that changes things. Now, UConn does have a pretty talented big off the bench. It's even more athletic, but he's not 7'2". So that's something to watch. The other thing is, will Edey get in foul trouble? Dealing with Klingon. You have Edey's in foul trouble, but Purdue's in deep, deep, deep trouble. So to me, I think Purdue can win. But I think more things have to go right for them to win than UConn.
Sure.
I think UConn can have a bad game from one of their best players, and they can still win. I'm not convinced that Klingon gets in foul trouble. Connecticut still can't win. But the biggest thing I keep coming back to, Dusty, when I look at this game is the biggest strength for Purdue is playing in with Edey and then playing out, playing inside, going out. And a lot of that is predicated on a one-on-one matchup against a guy that's usually smaller than him, so he can score. Even against a double team, sometimes he can split through there and score. But the other thing is the rest of their offense feeds off of throw it in, and then they double, and they kick it out. And that's what they did to beat NC State, as you saw in the Final Four on Saturday. And you have wide-open three-point shots. I'm not even convinced that UConn doubles. They can't still get out to some of these shooters. But if Klingon is out there, I don't think they have to double. And I'm Dan Hurley. I'm not worrying about doubling to start the game and see what happens.
Sorry, yeah.
But here's the other thing. Zach Edey is, and DJ Burns, we watched the Final Four the other day, those two guys, it was like throwback NBA basketball. Throw the ball into the good guy, let him dribble and pound it 10 times, put a dent in the floor, and then finally try to score. And Burns was the same way. And I was like, whoa, we're going back in time. I felt like I was in a travel time machine. And I was like, this is not, I don't really enjoy watching that as much, to be honest with you.
No.
Now, you throw it in to Edie. If he makes a quick move, a drop step, dunk, sweet. He makes a quick move, left shoulder hook, got it. But it takes him forever to get into what he wants to do. And I don't think that's going to work so well against UConn, especially when you got a guy that can body you up and just play straight up. He don't have to gamble. Nobody's got three-quarter front Edie anymore. Not in this game, I don't think, unless Klingon's on the bench. I think Edie's got a ton of pressure on him tonight. We're going to find – Edie is a great player. He's just not an NBA – he's not a great NBA player because of the way the game is. He would have been 20 years ago, 10 years ago maybe. And the Klingon, too. Klingon's going to be a better NBA player than Edie, in my opinion, because he's just going to do a lot of that other stuff. Block shots, rebound, and Edie can, too, but Klingon's more athletic. I think there's no doubt about that when you watch him. So he's maybe the better prospect for the way the game is today. But when I look at this game, I'm like, UConn doesn't have to go through Klingon. Purdue has to go through Edie. And I don't see Edie having a gigantic game tonight unless Klingon is in foul trouble or gets hurt. And that's possible. But I know I pick Purdue, and I really want to pick Purdue to win this game tonight. I do, because I want to be consistent all the way through. And I hate to jump on the wagon of everybody else picking UConn to win. But I'm having a hard – I think a lot of things have to go Purdue's way to win, which is crazy when you got a one versus a one, two best teams in America. I just think the strengths of Purdue can easily be neutralized by UConn and thus takes away what they like to do on offense. Purdue defensively might – you know, I might be able to do everything they need to do defensively. But I'm just trying to see if they don't double Edie, how they can get a lot of looks. And if you drive it, that's true. You got a big guy to lob it to. That's an advantage Purdue has that some teams haven't. Mm-hmm. If you go in and you draw Klingon to you and try to put up a floater and then a wraparound pass. And I hope it's a great game. I hope it's close all the way through. I'm pulling for Purdue. They haven't won a title. They haven't won a title.
No.
The last time they were in the title game was 1969, as Kevin Kluger mentioned. UConn always wins a title almost every time they go to the national championship game. They're 5-0 in the national championship game. But I'm just trying to use, instead of my heart, I'm trying to use my head. And my head tells me, don't let your heart fool you. Looking at this matchup, it actually is a good matchup for UConn, believe it or not.
Yeah, I feel like on paper, it's hard to pick Purdue in this game.
I agree.
Like I'm what you're talking about, and even, you know, you've watched it a little bit more than I have, probably men's basketball this year, so you'd know better than me. But I'm not seeing where it would take one of those, like, you know, remember Spike Albrecht, right? Like somebody hitting a bunch of shots there. Just blowing up out of nowhere for Purdue to win this game, in my mind. Edie might get some points, but like you said, I feel like he needs 20 at least the same way. Got to have a double-double like he did in the semifinal, right? Like, he's got to be controlling the glass on the other side, too, not allowing, you know, Klingon and all of them to get second-chance opportunities. So you got to control that part of it, too, and then he's got to have 20-plus points. And even on top of all of that, you know, maybe not 14 or 15, but Purdue's probably got to make 10 threes. Like, you know, on top of if Edie has that game. But if he doesn't, then I agree with you. They got to make like 14, 15, 16 threes just to counter what Connecticut can do, what UConn's going to bring to the table. So I think at the beginning of this tournament, I was kind of like you. Like, I don't want to ride UConn because the odds are not good for teams to repeat, right? To get back. But also, those teams that are trying to repeat typically get beat earlier in the tournament, too. Yeah. Like, Kansas lost in the second round, right? And so, the deeper a team like this that's so dang good gets, that's going to be way tougher to keep them out of repeating, right?
Yeah.
And so, and I think your best chances to have that happen is like a Duke UNLV. It's a rematch. Like, you saw them and got pummeled last year, and you're so mad about it. You want to turn things around. You know exactly who they are. You played them before.
Right.
You know the strengths and weaknesses, and that's not what Purdue is, right? Like, they don't know UConn inside and out. And so now you're getting into a spot where, you know, San Diego State would have been that team in the Sweet 16 that knows UConn inside and out because they just played them last year
and
in the
UConn
championship.
UConn crushed them.
And it was not a game at all. Yeah. And so the deeper this team gets into the tournament, the harder and harder it is to say no, they're not going to repeat. So I'm picking UConn to win by like 9 tonight, probably in the end. Purdue's obviously, I think, going to hang there with them and make it a game, but it's hard for me to pick Purdue.
Many times when you get close to making history, the teams come up short. I mean, we've seen this now for quite some time in professional sports, teams that try to repeat. But the Chiefs repeated this year. Is it the year of the repeat?
Yeah. So is it what's the destiny this year? Is it the 16-1 and then the one goes and wins a championship like Virginia did? Mm-hmm. Or is it the repeat like the Chiefs? Like, what's the destiny here for college hoops? Because there's two different storylines that could go.
Absolutely. Now, big news. John Calipari is expected to sign a contract today to become the next coach at Arkansas. Calipari and power players at Arkansas involved in serious talks over the weekend. And by last night, the school and Calipari entered into a verbal agreement. Sources say Kentucky officials had been made aware over the weekend through third parties that Calipari was looking into Arkansas and vice versa. The contract terms of Calipari's deal with Kentucky mandate he must inform his AD if he engages with another school about a job interview. Calipari's deal is expected to be for 5 years, pay north of $8 million per year. The school's biggest donors are also expected to inject millions more into Arkansas's NIL collective, potentially putting the program atop the list in the sport for the largest pool of resources. The family of John Tyson, Arkansas Athletics' biggest donor, is prepared to make a major commitment to land Calipari and pour millions in the men's basketball program. It's Tyson's Foods, by the way. He has some money. Calipari has a longstanding friendship with the Tyson family, including John Tyson. So he's been enticed by Tyson to come here. There's no secret that donors and supporters of Kentucky are not pleased with Calipari after their losses, and especially the last one against Oakland. Calipari is not very happy about not being wanted. And so I don't blame Calipari for looking elsewhere at all. Calipari spent the last 15 seasons as a leader of the Wildcats program. He would remain in the SEC, which is funny to me. And he succeeds Eric Musselman, who took the vacant job at USC earlier this month. Of course, Arkansas beat KU in the second round last year, and then this year they had a losing record. Calipari will have access to an NIL package that will rank among the best in college basketball, excess of $5 million per year. He also could bring his highly talented recruiting class, because he always has a great recruiting class. He is number 8, number 20, number 22, number 26, number 46, number 73 in the ratings for recruitings, including a center, a shooting forward, and a shooting guard, and 2-point guards in that mix. He could all maybe get to come to Arkansas. And this is the funny thing, and I do think it is funny. Kentucky's losing their coach to Arkansas because Arkansas lost their coach to USC because USC lost their coach to SMU. It's an absurd chain of events. That's what happened. Andy Enfield went from USC to SMU. All of a sudden, USC pops up, which you guys say, USC to SMU, does that make sense? But whatever, it might financially. So then Musselman says, okay, USC. So he goes to USC. Then there was a lot of reports there at the end of last week or the weekend that Jerome Tang was a top target at Arkansas to leave K-State to go to Arkansas. And then Tang decided to stay. So the next thing you know, here's Calipari coming in. They're like, wow, we can get Calipari. And so Calipari could go to Arkansas. Now, if you're sitting here as a K-State fan going, whoa, we dodged a bullet. Tang's not going anywhere. Think about this scenario. Kentucky needs a head coach. No, I'm not saying Jerome Tang. Kentucky needs a head coach. And the names that have been brought up, Kentucky fans still want Rick Pitino to come back again, which, you know, I don't know. But there's some names that are out there. You know, Nate Oates of Alabama is the one on the top of some people's list, and that would make some sense. I get it. But another name that's on that list is Scott Drew of Baylor.
Yeah.
And if Scott Drew did go to Kentucky, which I don't think he will, but if he did, all of a sudden, Baylor's open. Who would be the first call Baylor would make? I think it'd be Jerome Tang,
yeah.
So would Tang be interested in go to Baylor if Scott Drew went to Kentucky? And there would be some sense. One, he knows the Baylor program. Two, he'd stay in the Big 12. He knows the recruiting landscape. You know, if he went to Arkansas, it'd be a little bit different. Different conference, blah, blah, blah. And by the way, Calipari going to Arkansas is genius on his part. One, he makes a ton of money. Two, he goes to a program that hasn't been good for a while in regards to being, you know, they went to back-to-back national title games in 94-95, won a national championship with Nolan Richardson, but they're not the Kentucky level of blue blood. Mm-hmm. He goes to Arkansas, won't be as much pressure on him. He can have this big, huge NIL collective, and he can try to stick it to Kentucky and their fans and boosters and donors that didn't think he was good enough, and he can just flip the bird to them after he walks off the court and beats them at Rupp Arena with all these guys that were going to be at Kentucky because he didn't win enough in the NCAA tournament. And it'll be interesting to see who Kentucky gets. And if Alabama loses their head coach at Kentucky. That's in the SEC as well. So now you got musical chairs. So you got tons of plot lines and subplots in the future, and there could be some great rivalries that cause that. But I think it's hilarious that Calipari would leave Kentucky to go to another SEC school. And I think, listen, I'm not a gigantic fan of Calipari, the guy, but I respect what he does as a recruiter. He gets his kids paid. I mean, now probably even more so in NIL level, but he gets his kids paid. They go to the NBA, he gets these great recruits. It is amazing he only won one national championship with all the talent he had, but that just shows you the crapshoot that is the NCAA tournament. But this guy gets his kids paid. These kids know this. Where he's going to be, Arkansas or Kentucky, it don't matter where Calipari is. These kids know that Calipari's got all the connections.
Legally or illegally.
Right.
He's always got his kids paid.
Yeah, right. So he's going to take care of you, get you paid one way or the other, legally or illegally. He's going to get you an NBA if you're a great player. And so if you're a recruiting class, are you going to Kentucky to go to Kentucky, or you're going to Kentucky because Calipari can get you in the league and get you a lot of money? I'd be going, like, where does Calipari go? I'm going to consider going to Arkansas now. So Kentucky's going to lose out on some of these recruits without question. And so all these people are, like, not satisfied with winning and then say, well, we got all these recruits and they're fun to watch, but we don't end up winning championships. Now you're not going to have as good a recruiting class more than likely. And now are you going to be happy being a 7 seed or an 8 seed or a 9 seed maybe the first year for this new coach? Or maybe not. Maybe you'll be a top 2 or 3 seed like Calipari was almost all the time, and then you're going to do great in the tournament. But it is going to be careful what you wish for type of comment, right? Be careful what you wish for. You lost John Calipari. You wanted somebody new. Who are you going to go get? And then he goes to Arkansas and instantly has success and beats you head-to-head, and he wins the SEC with all great recruiting class. Now he's got all this money in an NIL collective to try to go get transfers. And this is what somebody pointed out. John Calipari is one of the best guys to pivot. He's pivoted from the normal landscape. He pivoted to the one-and-done player when they made that, you know, the situation with the NBA in college. He took full advantage of that with the one-and-dones. He's like, fine, I'll bring the one-and-dones. Bring me them 1 year. I'll make them a great player. Send them to the NBA. I'll take that talent. I'll deal with restocking the shelf every year, one-and-dones. Now, with the transfer portal, and how many great players are going to transfer portal, and now you got a whole bunch of NIL collective money reportedly going in the Arkansas coffers, now Calipari can shift and pivot again. He can still get one-and-dones, but now he can go after some of the best transfers in the portal because he's got more money to throw at him because of what they're willing to do with John Tyson Foods, and it all comes down to money again, doesn't it? But it is an interesting, intriguing situation, and there is a trickle-down effect that could impact Kansas State and our area if Scott Drew would be the guy who goes to Kentucky. I believe Jerome Tang would go to Baylor. I believe that. I believe he would go to Baylor if Scott Drew left, but I may be wrong.
That would be the only one place that I'd be worried about right now.
Yep.
All this noise that people were talking over the weekend about him possibly going to Arkansas, this noise that a certain media guy was pushing, just to basically, I think, push a president out earlier in this season, it was all noise. Like, I never believed for one second that Jerome Tang was going anywhere based on what's presented to us at the moment.
Right.
What's here right now in front of our table. Everybody was panicking. The Arkansas thing, like, so a guy tweets out that Arkansas will put Jerome Tang at the top of their list. That does not mean he's leaving.
No,
just because he's their top candidate now doesn't mean that he's gone.
No.
How many times has this happened with Lane's Leipold?
Oh, yeah.
It's just like, stop reading into things and panicking about everything the moment you see it. It was just driving me nuts this week.
And anybody can report that he's at the top of the list. You don't even know if they talked to Tang.
And you got people that think they're close to it. At one point saying he's going to stay. There's no way he's going to Arkansas. And in a different spot, they're saying he's going to leave. And it's like, no, that's not happening. So Baylor would be the only spot that I would actually legitimately start having some concern.
I agree with you.
Because of all the time that he spent there. But also, Scott Drew's not going to be there anymore. So the tie with Baylor is also not just the university, but also the coach, because he loves his people, Jerome Tang does. Mm-hmm. And if Scott Drew's not there, is that his spot if his person's not there? And so that could be a factor that could say, no, I'm not going to go there because Scott's not there anymore. That's my guy. That's my dude.
Right.
And so
that's true.
That could come into it too, right? And so,
but if Scott Drew contacts Jerome Tang and says, we built something so great here, and I hate to see this fall apart because I go to Kentucky. I think you're the perfect guy for this job, Jerome. You got to come back and take over the reins because I want this to be in a great situation because I'm going to Kentucky. But there's no doubt he'd be listening.
Yeah, and that's definitely the other side of it.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of different sides that you look at in these situations. So And there's also people that are saying if Nate Oates would go to Kentucky, that Drew might even go to Alabama.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's we're not clear if Nate Oates goes to Kentucky because there's still job openings in the SEC and a program that just made the Final Four. So it's – but that's also Kentucky's side of things if they're trying to get Nate Oates. It's like, oh, you're putting a decent risk out there for a guy that just did this once, right? Like, you know, obviously he's built the program to where it needs to be right now to go to the Final Four. But how many coaches do you see get there and then they never ever even get close or get back? And yeah, Frank Martin's an example in my mind of taking South Carolina, a team that really wasn't all that good, that just made a run, and his best teams never made it past the Elite Eight. And so – you know, you kind of look at these kind of things, and it's like that's a risk being taken there. And again, if I'm Calipari, though, we were talking about this last night. Somebody was like, why would you walk away from that kind of buyout? Just hold them hostage until they have to get rid of it, and you're going to get 30-some million. I'm like, I don't think the money matters as much anymore to Calipari for his personal finances because he's got enough of it, and he doesn't have to pay the players in his own pocket anymore. He's got an NIL. He can leave. He doesn't. The money doesn't matter anymore. It just he needs the money that's funneling in so he can pay the players out of the transfer portal, and that's not his responsibility anymore.
And he wants to be appreciated, and he wants to be happy. And he's clearly not happy there, and he's not appreciated there. And so he's like, I'll go somewhere where they do appreciate me, and I got a great friendship with a billionaire guy and John Tyson, and I can – pretty much tell Arkansas I'm really interested and I know I can demand about whatever I want and I'll get what I want, and then they're going to love me down there, and the expectations aren't as high as they are in Kentucky every year, national championship or bust. So to me, Calipari, some people may say it's a step down, you know, program wise it is, but in regards to his happiness and what he can do, and now he can also stick it to Kentucky. And if and the great coaches, by the way, they know they'll be good wherever they go. Great coaches don't go like, I got to take that job because that's the only way I can be good, I'm going to have all the access to the resources. That's nice to have, don't get me wrong, but great coaches have a huge ego, and great coaches believe they can win wherever they go, anywhere, any level. So if John Calipari says, hey, Arkansas might not be as flashy and sexy as Kentucky, but they don't appreciate me here, I've done everything I can here, I can take all the recruits I already got, I can shift them to Arkansas, and I can, and then what would be really sweet, I stick it to Kentucky head to head when I play them, and the expectations aren't quite as high, and I get $8 million a year, and I can legally pay players. Well, that doesn't sound like a bad deal after all. So, yeah, well, it sounds like that might become official today. We shall see. Stay tuned. If so, we'll talk about it tomorrow on The Ticket, brought to you by Kiefer Brothers Automotive in Beloit, your home for fast, friendly auto repair. Enjoy the rest of your day, everyone, and make sure to check out the Eclipse and don't run into anybody.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or SunflowerStateRadio.com.